Okay, so let's get going. So last lecture, we looked at the normal incidence of plane TEM waves on the boundary between two homogeneous propagation media. We made the first medium for the incident wave is a dielectric lossless so that the incoming wave is not attenuated. The second medium, we allowed it to be possibly a lossy medium. And then even we considered the second medium to have an infinite sigma, meaning that it's a perfect dielectric conductor, which we then called is a mirror, because in that kind of a situation, everything that is incident gets reflected and forms a standing wave pattern in the first medium. So in today's lecture, we pursue some of the applications of that material, that ideas that we developed last lecture, okay? And we start with this reflection from a PEC, perfect electrical conductor idea. In a PEC, there is going to be always no electric and magnetic fields. There cannot be any magnetic or electric fields. Therefore, the incident field is going to reflect in such a way so as to satisfy the boundary conditions of Maxwell's, which says that if, well, you can never have a tangential discontinuity in the electric field. So since the electric field inside is zero, the tangential electric field has to be equal to zero. And you cannot have any tangential discontinuity in H unless there is a surface current density, okay? Real materials do not furnish surface current density, but our idealization of a PEC does by our definition, okay? And therefore, when a field is incident, the incident field plus the reflected fields add up in its H to a quantity that is not equal to zero, but that is compensated by having a surface current density, okay? Now, I'm going to superpose the incident and the reflected fields and look at the structure of what I call a standing wave pattern. And first, let's just focus on that, okay? I sum up two phasors, one representing the incident field and the other representing the reflected field. The second one has a reflection coefficient in front of it, but that reflection coefficient is minus one. Because of that, when I sum the incident and the reflected, there is a minus sign that comes up, okay? The same reflection coefficient also appears in H. That is also minus one. But that minus one sees another minus one, and they get together to be a plus one, okay? That is because the direction of the H field is different, opposite to one another in the incident field and the reflected field. Okay, then the reflection, that is the first minus. But then the reflection coefficient itself is minus one, and then they get together to create an addition. All right? So I have, therefore, these two phasors. Okay? Now, in each of these phasors, I have a complex exponential added to itself, conjugated or subtracted. We know that when we see an addition of a complex exponential and its conjugate, we know that it is cosine, twice the cosine of the argument. When we see a subtraction, it is related to sine and divided by 2j. All right. So when we apply those two things, our phasors become these two guys. Okay. So h becomes a cosine function. Sine, the electric field becomes a sine function, and we are still in the phasor domain. We have just added two phasors. Okay. Now the sum of two phasors is still a phasor. Okay. But now, if you want to sort of go back to time domain, what we need to do? We multiply these phases by the common e to the j omega t and take the real part. And then what we will see is a superposition of two traveling waves that are traveling in opposite directions. We could have, of course, gone from the phasors first into time domain and then added them in time domain to get the same results. But in that case, we would be using a lot of trigonometry. We would have to remember all this sine, cosine, addition rules, etc. It's always easier to do that in the phasor domain, because then you don't have to remember those special things. Okay? So that's why I'm going to multiply these two quantities by e to the j omega t and take the real part. And when I do that, the fact that I have a minus j here, okay, is going to come up. Where did this minus j came up? It came because I divided by 2j and put a compensating 2j there. And that way I turned this into a sine function. Okay? And also, the order of minus and plus are the other way around. That will account for why there is a minus sign in front of that j as well. Okay? If you do that in two, three steps, you see that this is the correct result. Now, the fact that there is a minus j sitting in front of the e expression means that when I take the, when I go into the time domain by multiplying this e to the j omega t to the real part, instead of a cosine omega t term, I'm going to get a sine omega t term. However, the h function is going to be accompanied by a cosine omega t term. Okay, so let's do that. When we do that, we get these expressions that are given here. Okay? These are no longer traveling waves. You immediately recognize these are not traveling waves because the arguments of these functions are not of the type omega t plus or minus beta c. Okay? The telltale sign that you have a traveling wave is having a function argument that is in that fashion, omega t plus or minus beta z. They split into two terms. Now, z and t terms are sitting inside two different sine or cosine functions. These are standing waves, okay? And they are like the waves that I was illustrating by the animation I showed last lecture. Also, when we were kids and we played this rope game, you know, two kids hold the rope and one of them shake, you generate then standing waves. As soon as the wave goes and hits your friend and reflects back, you sort of like set up a standing wave pattern that you are all familiar with. Okay? It's just a matter of plotting these things now as a function of z and as a function of t, if you will. Okay? And such plots are shown on the side. These are consistent with those standing wave rope patterns that you may have experienced. And it's a busy thing. I'm plotting things as a function of z first at a given t, and if t is equal to such that omega t is 90 degrees, I'm going to get the tallest amplitude sine wave that is plotted as a function of z, but at other times it becomes smaller, etc. Okay? But what is important is that this, for this electric field thing, the electric field is having a node. It is going to zero exactly at z equal to zero. Remember, the z equals zero surface is the surface of reflection. You want the tangential electric field to be zero there all the time because there is no electric field inside, and that is exactly what you get because the sine dependence gives you that. Or because you have enforced that rule, you ended up having a sine dependence and everything is in order in that fashion. Now, our cosine function, however, which cosine of beta z, cosine omega t, which is the sort of function that describes the standing wave pattern associated with h sub y, shows a maximum at z equal to zero. Okay, so there is a tangential h. We know that tangential h is zero inside, because inside the PEC all the h's are zero, but we don't worry about it. We say there is a surface current density that compensates, so Maxwell's boundary condition equations are not violated. That's the way things are. Okay, and again, if you don't like this picture, the picture that you should be enjoying is the animation, because the ambiguities about space and time are resolved. You really see what is going on in animation. Okay, now, let us then say that if we take that function for h and evaluate it at z equals zero, we get this very special tangential h component that has to be matching to the surface current density, okay? And how is that match going to be? If it is h, surface current density and h have the same units, okay? So they are going to have the same functional relationship. It's only their directions are different. That is all. And how do you select the right direction? The J direction and H direction are not the same. They are different by 90 degrees. And how do you select the right one? Either using the boundary condition equation properly by selecting your N hat, etc. Or alternatively, which rule? Right hand rule. Yeah, I would do just right hand rule. Okay. So that's it. So there is a surface current density in the surface of this PEC. And exactly what it is given here. Okay. This 2E naught divided by eta 1 is the H field. The same thing shows up here. Okay. That is the surface current density. Any questions? E naught goes to zero, then there is no waves, there is no reflections, etc. Everything is linearly scaling with E naught, and nothing surprising over there. All right, so if no questions, I would like to now discuss the relationship of this idealized picture, one that includes this PEC, which doesn't really exist in real life, to something that will exist in real life, okay? We are going to find out if instead of the second region being a PEC, it is a very good conductor, say copper, such that at the operation frequency we may assume good conductor situation. Sigma over omega epsilon is much larger than 1, therefore alpha and beta are equal to one another, and they are equal to the square root of, Jason, pi mu sigma f. All right, suppose that that is the case, okay? So then I claim, then I make a claim. In that case, there will not be a surface current density. There will be a volumetric current flowing in the second region. But in that region, the current as well as electric fields will be decaying exponentially quite fast. And if I take the volumetric current density, okay, which is flowing parallel to the electric field, which exists now because it's not a PEC, and I take that current density, integrate along the z-axis, I will end up with a reduced current density after this one-dimensional integration. That is going to equal that surface current density. I will integrate that volumetric current density with units of amperes per meter squared along one direction. It will collapse to amperes per meter, and it will exactly collapse to this quantity. Okay? So that is significant. That is why, even in real situations where there is no surface current density, all the currents are inside, we say, hey, we'll pretend there is a surface current density that is given to us without doing much of any calculation except for using the boundary conditions, pretending our copper is really a PEC. All right? So we can get the line integral of the volumetric current density inside the copper by just pretending that copper is a PEC. Okay? That's one result that I want to show. Any questions here? So, and that discussion, that derivation is provided just in this sort of box. It is an example, if you will. Okay, so I have some results here. Okay, let's look at these equations. Suppose that our second medium is indeed a finite conductivity region. We have an incident field, we have a reflected field, and we have a transmitted field. What is the transmitted electric field? What is the transmitted H? What kind of a current the transmitted electric field is driving inside that medium? All those details are given in the margin. Look at the margin. Do you guys agree? Jason, let's look at the E transmitted. Does that make sense? I presumably had an X-polarized incident wave with an amplitude E naught. It got transmitted into the second medium with some transmission coefficient tau. And because I am moving in a lossy medium, I have an exponential e to the minus gamma 2 c. That gamma 2 has alpha plus j beta, and I will assume those alpha plus j alpha and beta to be the same. I'm going to assume that's going to be square root of pi mu sigma f. All right? Now, the corresponding h is also given, but so is corresponding j. Okay? Proportional to e, if I multiply it with the conductivity of the second medium, I have j. Okay? I can now work out what that J is and do the integration in Z. Integration in Z is going to be not so bad because I know what function it is. Okay? I know what function it is, and I will be able to do that integration as well. The details are all given here. And I will not go through the details. Okay, it is something that you can examine on your own, because more than the details, what is important is the upshot. Okay, so as I already advertised, I will take all the relationship for lossy propagation, the etas and the gammas, and interpret them in the good conductivity case, and that is exactly what I'm doing. I am in eta, I am neglecting the epsilon 2 and just sticking with the sigma 2 version. And my gamma 2 is going to have that representation that splits into alpha plus j beta with equal alpha and beta, because square root of j gives you this 1 plus j divided by square root of 2 beta. Things that we have seen previously. Okay? Then I calculate my transmission coefficient. And then I calculate a few other things. The details are not so important. Finally, I am able to do the integration. I am going to now... my sigma 2 tau, for which I can all substitute, sigma 2 tau became this thing, okay? And MIE 0, and this is, of course, my entire J, right? This is the entire J that I'm integrating, and it is coming because sigma 2 times the entire E, and sigma 2 times tau, I'm going to substitute this. I have an exponential to integrate, and I do that. The result is
what I wanted to obtain. This compares with what we had as the surface current density. We got twice E0 divided by 8 and up, okay? This is twice, and that is the, this is a phasor, you turn it into time domain. How do you turn it into time domain? You multiply by e to the j omega t and take the real part, that gives you a cosine omega t relationship. And here we go, okay? The integral of the volumetric current density became exactly what we found in the previous page by applying the boundary condition and assuming the copper not to be copper but a PEC, we got the same result. Any questions? So, how is this important? How can this be applied? Well, it can be applied now in terms of a further development. You may be wondering, now, what kind of Joule heating taking place? How much energy is being wasted in this region? Okay, if this is what you want to calculate, you have two options. One of them is actually go there and do even further work. J dot E, you have to integrate. J dot E will give you amount of power dissipated per unit volume, and then you can integrate it along the Z direction, and then you can get the amount of power dissipated per unit area that is exposed to the incoming field. So that would be the calculation. And the next page does that calculation. But at the end of that calculation, there is a lesson to be learned. That lesson is, you can derive a parameter that we call the surface resistance of the copper. Okay? It is measured in ohms. That is good enough for you to calculate the entire power that is input into this mirror, because it's not a perfect conductor, but a real-life conductor. Power per unit area, by simply going 1/2 surface resistance times the square of the surface current density. That surface current density is something that you can obtain just pretending the copper to be a PEC, okay? By doing that, you get the surface current density, but the copper is not PEC. It has a finite surface resistance. You have also derived that quantity, and by using the simple relationship, this is basically what sometimes people call perturbation theory approach, okay? You are pretending what you have, which is not a perfect conductor, to be perfect conductor for a while until you get one useful parameter. In this case, that useful parameter is the surface current density. And then you use another derived quantity that was obtained by doing something that is not assuming the medium to be a perfect electrical conductor, but a damn good one. Damn good one is because we use we ignore the epsilons in favor of sigmas. We use the sigma terms and not the epsilon terms. This is the gist of the perturbation theory. Perturbation theory can be justified when you have almost an ideal situation, but not quite. Any questions here? So that second derivation is coming in the second page, and perhaps you can sort of pay attention to this as well. As I advertised, now that I know my J, I can certainly dot multiply it with E, I would get J dot E. And then I would integrate that quantity over the Z direction, okay? Ultimately, when I finish that, what I find is 1/2 some quantity times the magnitude square of the surface current density. The derivation gives me what this R sub S is. It is pi F mu divided by sigma. Okay. So that is a quantity that you can easily calculate once you know your material, copper, whatever, aluminum, and there you have. It is also, if you want to go and Google surface resistance, Wikipedia is going to give you a page of describing all this stuff, plus the values that you might use for common materials and so forth. Okay? So this is a very, very sort of a useful technique. Down the line in ECE 350, when we are studying various waveguide modes and cavities, we will always make the assumption that we have a PEC surfaces. Our bonding stuff are PEC. We will get all sorts of results. But then say, hey, although we did this, it really is not the case that we are using PEC. There is some amount of attenuation and loss that's going on. And how are we going to calculate that? We calculate that using this concept, okay? We still rely on our solutions based on PEC. We look at the surface H at the boundaries of the waveguide. We turn those surface H's into equivalent surface currents, okay? Even though there is really no surface current, it's all inside, but we have done our math. J just then, square it, multiply it 1/2 the surface resistance, we get our attenuation constants.
Any questions?
So this kind of stuff that I'm discussing today are applications. They are a little bit more detailed than typical topics that we cover in this course. But slowly, you need to move into these higher level sort of concerns as the course gets larger and larger. Yeah.
So this is only apply to perfect conductors.
So, listen to what I'm saying. I'm saying something maybe that is not so easy to comprehend. I'm not saying that it applies to perfect conductors. I am saying that it applies to good conductors, to very good conductors, under the condition sigma is much larger than omega times epsilon. Okay? That corresponds to the third column in our previous lecture. Under those situations, okay, we play this game. Sometimes in some problems, we treat our very good conductor as if it was a perfect conductor to get some results. And then we say, but that was just a perturbation approach. That was just that perturbation theory approach is a sort of a nice name saying I'm just being not exactly correct, but justifiably correct. It's a good approximation that I'm using. All right, so you get the surface current density using, pretending you have a PEC. And then you say, but I didn't have a PEC. I have a surface resistance that is finite. It's not zero. I have to square my current and multiply with surface resistance to find out how much power is being sucked into this medium. It is not a perfect reflector. Not everything that is incident comes back. There's a tiny difference. What comes back is most of what I had, but something is being lost. And that something being lost is obtained by this perturbation. Okay? So the answer is, this doesn't all apply to PEC. It applies to good conductors. In their treatment, PEC is playing a role. Okay? So there is one more similar exercise I can go through, and that is the last example that we have before we start talking about transmission lines. And that is the calculation of radiation pressure. So the same scenario. We have we have a real-life mirror, okay? Light is coming, and it is reflected back. This light is pushing this thing also, okay? So this calculation shows the so-called radiation pressure related to the momentum content of the plane waves. How do we do that? Okay? So because this is really not a PEC, there is a penetration of this incoming electric field somewhat into the second medium. Of course, you have an exponential decay of the amplitude there, very fast within the skin depth and all that. But where the electric fields are, there is currents, there is motion, there is an accompanying magnetic field as well. There is actually a Lorentz force that you should think about that is applicable to on each charge carrier. Each charge carrier is being subjected to a Lorentz force. Now, there are so many charge carriers per unit volume. Okay, I can get the force per charge carrier and multiply it with the number density of charge carriers and develop a sort of a expression for force per unit area. And what is force per unit area? Now, chemistry 102 or whatever. Force per unit area is?
Pressure.
Yeah. Okay, so that is what we basically do here. Okay? So look at the top equation. In the top equation, I take Lorentz force and simply multiply it with the density. Okay, so this B is the B that accompanies the E that is coming in. This is not Earth's magnetic field. This is not DC magnetic field. It is the accompanying B that is accompanying E. Okay? When I do this multiplication, I say, hey, NQB is effectively my J. So J cross B is a force. Okay? And this was F is in newtons, but N is, what is N? It is 1 over meter cube, okay? So then I have newton per meter cube. I'm going to integrate this quantity all the way in the z direction, and then newton per meter cube is going to become newton per meter square. And that is force per unit area. That is pressure, okay? So that is the calculation I do. I'm not going to bore you with the details. Okay, but we have all the ingredients to do that calculation because in the previous two problems, we worked out what E is, we worked out what J is, and B was there too, okay? H was there, but H and B can be exchanged. And I do that calculation, and at the end, we find a result, okay? I already called the time average value of the integral of this quantity in Z direction my radiation pressure, and I find that to be proportional to the point flux of the incident field divided by C. All right. So that is then the amount of power per unit area that this mirror is being pushed by, simply because this TEM wave is coming and reflecting from it, okay? So there is sort of like Newton's idea of recoil is in play here, okay? You are pushing back the electromagnetic field by reflecting it, but in doing so, you are being pushed away as well, okay? So this is a real effect. So in summary then, these electromagnetic waves not only carry energy, which is of course what we focus on so much through Poynting's theorem and Poynting's vector and so forth, but they also carry momentum. They even carry angular momentum depending on their polarization states and so forth. Okay? And that is not all that surprising. Any questions? So this was a little bit of a show and tell, and Poynting flux divided by C for a plane wave. If you take the magnitude of this, this becomes the energy density. What is energy density? 1/2 epsilon E squared plus 1/2 mu H squared. Okay, you can, for a plane wave, you can actually show this is equal to energy density. So that's an interesting fact that you should keep in mind at some point. I can ask this in the exam, because you know the formula for W, you know the formula for S. I can show that for a plane wave, it is true that S divided by C magnitude equals the energy density. I expect that you will be able to do that. Right? Because you know what C is. What is C? 1 over square root of mu naught epsilon naught, right? So that is going to combine with the epsilon naughts and mu naughts that are associated with the energy densities, and that will turn things into a Poynting flux, effectively. Because a Poynting flux is E cross H. So you will have to sort of do a little bit of arithmetic, but it is certainly a legitimate question to ask. And also, if you look at this from the perspective of dimensional analysis, Poynting flux is watts per meter square, okay? And well, what is watts? Joules per second, okay? And C is meters per second. So there's per seconds that's going to just go away, but you're going to have joules per meter cubed. So dimensionally, it looks like it should be energy density, and it is indeed the energy density. Okay. All right, so let's stop here with this world of plane waves, reflections, radiation pressures, etc. But you step out from here with the knowledge that these fields and waves are real things. Okay, they are ELMO. They are hard to conceptualize sometimes. However, they are real things. Okay. I want to now go and change topics, go and start talking about transmission lines. We are still ahead of the game, right? According to the schedule, like half a lecture or something like that. All right, so now, we are now going to make use of the EM stuff that we learned in this class in service of circuit analysis. We are going back to circuit analysis, effectively. We are entering the last one-third of this course in the regular school year, more or less the same in the summer term as well. And this is all going to be circuit analysis, but distributed circuit analysis rather than lump circuit analysis. And basically, let me start with the following idea. Suppose that I have a source, and let me represent this source by a Stevenin model. Okay, some source resistance, or I can call R sub G, in series with its source. And this can be cosinusoidal, or it can be something else. It doesn't matter at this point. So B G of T, as I say. All right? So now, in lump circuit analysis, in EC210, we sometimes put a capacitor here, we put an inductor, or we put a resistor here, but they were all local. There were two terminal elements that were all local, and we did not really think of space. X, Y, Z never came into our pictures. The closest thing to space was the fact that there are nodes. Okay, we paid attention to nodes. Nodes were making some connection to spatiality of the problem, but the spatiality was not handled simply by assuming the size is so small, space doesn't matter. We can handle everything in terms of nodes. We measure voltages between the nodes, and we measure currents in elements that are connecting nodes to other nodes. Okay, and in a resistor, the current was same anywhere in that resistor. Okay, that resistor in principle could be 1 centimeter long, but if you cut that resistor at any length along this, you find the same current. That was the assumption. Okay, but now
That is, all that stuff is not valid, strictly speaking, because of the time delays associated with the finite propagation speed. And the inaccuracies become important if the size, the physical size of the system is large. If the physical size is small, then inaccuracy is who cares, and we do the lump circuit analysis. But now, I'm going to take two long wires, and then I will put a lump element on the other side. I will call this R sub L. These two long wires, L is the length, is perhaps comparable to a wavelength, or perhaps much larger than that, okay? If it is much smaller than a wavelength, and what is much smaller? A factor of 10, okay? Then you can go back to what you had in ECE 210. But otherwise, you have to now play the new game, okay? In this new game, we consider these two pairs of wires to be a transmission line. And we then say that if at t equals 0, I suddenly connect the transmission line to my source, as soon as at t equals 0 I close this, there is going to appear a voltage right at the input terminals, but that voltage is not going to be felt at the load until a travel time for that new signal takes place. That there's going to be a delay. That delay in general is going to be L divided by V. Only L after L divided V, there is going to be a voltage measure across this resistor. Okay? And in the interim period, this wire is going to be weird in the sense that there is going to be current in some portion of it, but zero current on the other side yet. In other words, the current that we are going to assume after we close the switch that are equal and opposite, okay, they are stopping somewhere. Where they stop is the wavefront that is progressing at this peak V. Okay? This V may be C, but typically it is less than C, and that depends on the construction of the transmission line. In particular, what kind of a material is occupying the vicinity of the two conductors? That becomes an effect. If you have an air-filled transmission line, in other words, conductors surrounded by air, that V is going to be C, but typically it is somewhat smaller. Okay? So there is going to be the current waveform that will be propagating with velocity V. Okay? So don't get this very confusing, because current describes the motion of charges, okay? But it is also a signal that can travel with a velocity. Don't mix these two things together. Okay? You already know that the currents are carried by electron motions in wires that are extremely small compared to the speed of light. But that wavefront of the current is itself going to be moving substantially at close to the speed of light. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that we want to sort of explore, but it gets very confusing at this stage. How are we going to do that? Well, we're going to now erase all this and come back to this later on. Instead of looking at this problem, we will look at some problem that derives from our newfound experience and relative comfort with plain electromagnetic waves. Let's start with plain electromagnetic waves. Okay? Suppose that this is, that picture over there is relevant. Okay? So maybe I should talk in terms of those pictures instead of the blackboard. Okay? I first imagine that I have a homogeneous medium, maybe vacuum, it doesn't matter. I have a plain electromagnetic wave. I saw it's E and H and E cross H. Energy is going in this direction. I have a standard electromagnetic wave. I call that unguided uniform plane wave propagation in a homogeneous medium. We know all their properties. E and H have ratio that is given by eta, and their directions are compliant with the right-hand rule and so forth. Now, I perturb this situation very carefully. I can perturb it in various ways. I can put a metallic sheet that is normally incident for this, and then what will happen? Our previous two lectures is going to be relevant. There will be that reflection. That is a very major perturbation of the initial electromagnetic wave. All right? However, if I take my plate and place it the way I show here, so that the plates themselves are parallel to the E cross H vector, then there is going to be very minor perturbation. Nothing really has changed. My initial plane wave is still alive. I have not reflected it. I have not completely shorted it or killed it. But there is some interaction between those plates and the fields. And let's sort of like think about that interaction. For simplicity, let us think that these plates are made of PEC. Okay? In reality, they will be copper. But let's assume that they are PEC. If they are PEC, tangential electric fields have to be equal to zero. But I have carefully placed my plate such that indeed tangential electric fields are equal to zero. My electric field is only normally interacting with this plate. It is normal, and that is fine. A normal electric field can go to zero because there could be a compensating. Yes, say it. Surface charge density. Okay? There could be a surface charge density that accounts for why a non-zero electric field on one side becomes the zero electric field on the inside. This is similar to a non-zero tangential H implies the existence of a surface current density, as long as we are assuming PEC. But even if we are not assuming PEC, even if we have copper, the same situation is relevant through the utility of what I call perturbation analysis. Okay? So we are in good shape. So I claim that in this case, the field survives. There is going to be field inside as well as outside, and they will, however, be compensated by surface currents and surface charge densities. Do you see the surface current density, for instance, David? Let's analyze the surface current density for a moment. Let's say that we are on this surface, okay? And there is a tangential H, okay? And that is going to generate a surface current density that is 90 degrees away from it. Their sizes are going to be the same. H and J sub S will have the same magnitude, but the directions are different. And what direction is the current? Let me just use my right-hand rule. If I assume my current was in this direction of the blue arrow, then my fingers are doing the right thing to comply with the direction of H. So I'm going to have a surface current density in the bottom plate going in plus Z direction, as indicated. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so that is surface current density. What's the unit of surface current density? Amperes per?
Amperes per
meter. Right. Now, but I have W meters of this plate. So if I take that W meters and multiply it with the surface current density, my amperes per meter becomes amperes. It becomes an I. So basically then, by having these plates embedded in this place where there used to be a magnetic field, you get into a situation where there's a current I that is flowing on one conductor. Now, if you were to analyze, David, the current on the top conductor, but the same face, bottom face of the top conductor, you can see that it's going to be opposite direction. So that's nice. And it's sort of like intuitive, right? Equal and opposite currents flowing on the two faces that are facing one another to compensate for the H field, which hasn't budged. That H field that was there is still there, but now these currents are flowing. Now, you can continue with the story, the analysis on the top surface and bottom surface, and you will see that this current will actually turn around and continue on the other side to become the current on the top of the top surface, okay? And on the bottom surface, there will be, on the bottom of the bottom surface, there will be a current coming this way that will turn into this. Okay? So there are two different field systems. One is inside, one is outside, or maybe two are outside. They are all going along with their currents, and then we have a sort of a steady state sinusoidal equilibrium here that is going on, assuming that the field is cosinusoidal. So Maxwell's equations are happy, the boundary conditions are happy, but there are currents, and there are also charge densities associated. The reason why there are charge density associated with them is because these currents are not necessarily, since we have a wave, that wave is cosinusoidal, that means this current has to be cosinusoidal, okay? If the current is cosinusoidal in the z direction, the current density is cosinusoidal in the z direction, there is a divergence to it, and if there is divergence to the current, what is there? Say. From the continuity equation, if there is a divergence for J, there is a corresponding charge density. And that charge density is the required charge density to meet the electric fields that we have. So everything actually is all full self-consistent, all right? And we find very much of a comfort in that, obviously. This is why we trust Maxwell's equation so much. Over many, many exercises like this, we find the situation is always the same. Now, we're going to take a slight leap. I'm going to now say, somehow, let us suppress the currents that are flowing on the top of the top surface and on the bottom of bottom surface, And let us assume there are no fields anywhere except for in between these plates. Okay, that is something of interest for me. Okay? And how can I maintain that? Well, I have some difficulty, but I think I can manage it. Okay? That current that's coming on the top and this current. Why don't I join the top plate and the bottom plate with a current source? Okay? I have this current coming in, and then it is continuing here. Right now, it is self-consistent with the top and the bottom. I have killed the current on the top surface of the top of the top surface, but I am going to now let this current, which is on the bottom of the top surface, not just hit the boundary, but continue through some element that I may call the current source. Okay? So then I make the following leap to the previous picture. If I have two plates, okay, I can excite those plates with electromagnetic waves in between the plates using current sources or voltage sources. A current source, an ideal current source, of course, is an ideal current source in real life. I don't have ideal current sources, but I can put a parallel a Norton or Thevenin resistance to it. And then I can also think of that parallel combo as the through source transformation a voltage source in series with a resistor. Okay? So now this picture is starting to become like the picture I had at the beginning. Because at the beginning I started asking the question, what if I take a pair of wires and connect a source, okay, what's going to happen? Well, we are now marching towards a sort of a formalism, a set of equations where this will be addressed. Any questions now? So I'm now claiming the fact that if you have two parallel plates, forget about the first and initial plane wave that was permeating all space, that was just a ruse. Now we are over that. We take two parallel plates and connect them with a voltage source or a current source, practical one. We are going to excite currents and charges on those surfaces. Equal and opposite currents will be excited on the top and bottom surfaces. And in between those surfaces, there is going to be E's and H's that will be moving. And those E's and H's will be moving just like E's and H of parallel plane TEM waves move. And we know how that motion takes place in compliance with Maxwell's equations. We can go back and solve Maxwell's equations once again. So that's where we are. Any questions? So let's make this a little bit even more specific in the next page. The same picture. Now I'm going to make some assumption. I'm going to say that, hey, I have a parallel plate. I will make it wide. I will make their separation small. I will start looking at this as if it was sort of a parallel plate capacitor. In parallel plate capacitor, we knew about the fringe fields outside and the uniform sort of fields inside. And if the fringe fields are small, I don't worry about them. I make things a little bit idealized. I will say, in between these two plates, with sufficiently small plane separation compared to all the other dimensions, I'll make the assumption that the fields are uniform, as if they belong to a uniform plane wave. And outside they are zero. In reality, outside they are not zero. They sort of like do this. But who cares? There are not so many of those fields, and that's not very relevant. And of course, this is easy for a parallel plate, and I'm picking parallel plate because I can do the math easily. There are different types of transmission lines, okay? The most common transmission line is not parallel plate, although parallel plate is also common, okay? Printed circuit boards, you have many situations which are effectively parallel plate transmission lines, but the most common one is the coax, of course, an inner conductor of some radius A embedded in an outer conductor of radius B is the coax. And there, too, I can do the same sort of exercise. I can put a current source here and then imagine that there will be equal and opposite currents on the inner and outer conductor. This is sort of now start becoming related to our inductor inductance per unit length, capacitance per unit length calculations. And then I will have to get the electric fields that have some symmetry. Electric fields are going to point out radially. We know how to calculate them. There's going to be H's that are azimuthal, etc. So that is not a bad geometry. I could also pursue this problem there, but it's a little bit more complicated. And then the problem gets really more complicated if we have a twin wire. Two wires that are parallel to one another, which is sort of like, looks like this. And this is also a legitimate transmission lines. In the olden days, we used to connect TVs to antennas. We don't do that anymore.
And that the cables that we use were typically twin wires. They are usually embedded in some plastic insulator. And so you maintain a definite uniform separation between the two wires. You always assume in using these things that your system is homogeneous in the direction of propagation, Z direction. Otherwise, you generate complexities. But those complexities we will learn how to handle piecewise. Okay, so these are the problems that we need to solve, but the easiest is this class, okay? Parallel plate capacitor is very easy. Now I make my assumption. In between the plates, I'm going to have an X-directed electric field that depends only on Z and T. That makes sense, right? We in fact know a lot about that. It's going to have in phasor domain E to the J plus or minus beta Z type of relationship. There's an accompanying H that is in Y direction as shown here, all right? And let us just like go into Maxwell's equations. For a moment, let's forget what we know about plane waves and revisit Maxwell's equations for completeness sake. With those assumptions of those two fields, they are the ones that are relevant in between the two plates. Ultimately, when I solve them, after I solve them, I'm going to do the following. I'm going to take that electric field, all right, for which I have a solution, and I will integrate it from the bottom plate to the top plate. When I do a line integral of an electric field, I call that voltage. It's going to be interpreted as a voltage. Voltage drop from one plate to the other. And what is going to be very sort of important is that you can define such voltage drops for every different value of Z for different positions along the line. Okay? And you don't want ever to integrate from bottom plate to top plate from starting at one Z and ending up another Z. That is confusing. We are always going to integrate from top to bottom at fixed values of Z and call it V of Z. Okay? This is a time-varying situation. You should be aware that electrostatic solutions are not necessarily going to work. In general, they are not going to work. But it turns out that you still have a curl-free type of an interpretation if you stick to each of the Z constant planes. I'm going to talk about that a little bit further down the line. Okay, and also I will have my H's, I will turn my H's at the boundaries into J sub S's, and I will turn J sub S's into I's. All right? Effectively, H sub Y times W will become I, because H sub Y is actually J sub X, and J sub X times W is I. That is what I'm going to do. Okay, but before I do that, with these assumptions of, I have assumed the polarizations, okay? And with those polarizations, I visit the two equations, the two curl equations of Maxwell. Because only certain scalar components are relevant, I identify those scalar components. When I take the curl of E for the given E, only the X term contributes, okay? And the X term is associated, only X term contributes, E sub X contributes because there is only E sub X. But evidently, it's coming from not X component, but which component? Say. You can the information is there. HY is showing up on the other side. Therefore, it must be coming from? You, kidding. All right, so, you know, you don't force me into taking a curl of E. It is X, Y, Z, dx, dy, dz, of then EX, EY, EZ. But there is no EY, there is no EZ. The non-zero component is going to come because of the negative DDZ of E sub X, and that is going to be touching Y. Okay? And that is why I see the H sub Y on the side. Okay? So for a moment, I confuse myself, then I unconfuse myself. This is coming from the Y component of this equation, and there is no other component to this equation. The other components of this equation are 0 equals 0. Okay? All right, so then, similar thing with the second equation. We now take the curl of H, H being Y polarized, and that gives me an X component where I have this equation. I have two scalar equations. Any questions? Did I go too fast? Did I confuse people? Jason, did I confuse people? Or are you with me? Are you with me? You guys are with me? Okay, so we have two scalar equations. I am more or less where I want to be, okay? I will take each of these equations and multiply them with the separation between the two plates. I need a name for that. It's D, okay? I will multiply these equations with D, okay? And every time I see E sub X times D, I will call it B. That's going to be my voltage. Because my plane waves are constant, my integration is just simply multiplication. This is the value of doing it in a parallel plane. If we were doing it in a coax, our integration would have to be real integration, and we would be picking all this ln of A over B type of terms. But this is even easier. Okay? So my E sub x times D becomes B, and it is the voltage drop from plate 2 to plate 1. Are we good with this? Okay, so now I rewrite my two equations to reflect that. Okay? In the center equation, I no longer have E sub x. I have V's. This V stands for E sub x times D. What is it now time to do? Multiply both of these equations with W. When I do that, I'm going to see H sub y times W terms, and I will interpret them as I's. And there we go. I is H sub y times W. Any questions about this? Any confusion? John, did you follow that? Once again, that I is W times the surface current density, but surface current density's magnitude is the same as H sub y. That's why. Okay? So then, when I multiply these two guys and make this substitution, I get the equations on the bottom. And I'm just about to stop, but I have to finish cleaning these up because these become the sort of the mirror image of Maxwell's equations that are relevant for the world of transmission lines, known as telegrapher's equations. In the 1800s, telegraphy became something. Even before everything was sorted out in Maxwell's equations and so forth, already in England there was telegraphy going on. And telegraphers were using transmission lines for their systems. Okay, so these are telegrapher's equations. And they look messy now, but I will bring order to them. Okay, so at this stage they look messy. But then I will turn them into equations that are similar in some sense to the voltage current relations of inductors and capacitors. Let me stop. I will start with that. And then we will solve these equations, and then we will see how pulses are propagated along these.
Professor, I have a quick question.